Dan's subtracting his current. He's gone.
He's gone.
No. Open the House Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources. It is April the 6th. Good morning, everybody. Let me see if I can give anybody any relief here. We're going to carry over the work session on House Bill 2099 until Tuesday. I was going to get a little update, but not all the parties nor our legislator who was involved are present, so I probably won't get an update at this point, but we can get those offline from people. So let me carry over the work session on House Bill 2099. And unfortunately, the rest of you will have to sit here and wait for everybody else's bills to be heard. So the typical protocol, if we have a legislator who's got to get somewhere, we take their testimony first. Representative Wisnett fits that bill this morning. So I'm not sure how long the list is on House Bill 2222, but we're at least going to do the representative. And then if the list is short, we'll do the others. If the list is long, then we'll come back to this later. So let me open a public hearing on House Bill 2222. Ask Representative Wisnett to join us. We will ascertain shortly how many people there are behind you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, Vice Chairs, Honorable Committee members. Thank you for hearing House Bill 2222 relating to regional land use. For the record, I'm Gene Wisnett, State Representative, House District 53. Committee members and Chair, Central Oregon, Deschutes County specifically are experiencing large population growth. In fact, Deschutes County is one of the fastest growing counties in Oregon and the United States. This growth creates for our local communities good and bad challenges, including a major affordable housing issue. Our statewide land use system impacts this situation. Many people in the past, since I've been in the building, have proposed considering regional land use policy. In fact, on May the 10th, 2012, Governor Kitzhaber issued Executive Order Number 12-07 to allow three southern Oregon counties to participate in a pilot project to develop regional land use rules. Central Oregon's three counties were identified as the second group to participate in another pilot project. This bill with the -3 amendment asks that other counties or county may conduct a study which is modeled on the study guidelines created by LCDC for the pilot project for Southern Oregon counties. House Bill 2222-3 states that the counties or county may participate in the study and do so with no state funding. Mr. Chair, that concludes my comments, but I'm not sure how many more people you have. Nick Lalick drove over from Deschutes County. Nick is the director of Deschutes County Planning Department, and he's worked with AOC and the other county planners to present you more details, and he has all the background on the -3 amendment. So thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
You bet. So I do have Nick up next, but we have like 10 people after that, so we're not going to do this hearing right now. But before you leave, we do have one question at least from a committee member for you.
Thank you.
Vice Chair McClain.
Thank you, Representative Wisnett. One of the things that you just mentioned was that it could be a county or counties, and there's fewer cities on the other side. So how many cities would be possibly in one county and versus three counties or two counties or in that area?
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair McClain, Deschutes County has Sisters, Redmond, Bean, and Lapine, so that's four. Jefferson has Madras, Culver. I think are the only two cities. Crook County has Prineville.
Okay. All right.
And Mr. Chair and Vice Chair, really the growth is in Redmond and Bend and Sisters, too. Sisters is having tremendous growth in that area, but mostly it's Bend and Redmond.
I just wondered what the definition of regional was versus just a county, because it seems like, you know, sharing roads, sharing jobs, sharing houses, that all of those issues make a difference on what the region is.
Yeah. Mr. Chair and Vice Chair, Central Oregon has always been designated as Jefferson, Crook, and Deschutes. and it's 97. They share 97, except Crook County is a little off, 97. I have a resolution coming up about how Crook County would have been the biggest city, or Primeville would have been, if they didn't choose to have the railroad come through there.
Thank you.
Representative Escobar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is kind of a hybrid of what we have done in the past. We had the regional problem-solving, RPS process in Southern Oregon, where we had all the municipalities got together, and it was a very painful thing because we had no guidance. We didn't have anything. We didn't even know what we didn't even know, I guess one would say. But they struggled through that on a 12-year period and finally got something in writing to where they have Central Point, Medford, Ashland, Grants Pass, I mean, not Grants Pass, but Phoenix, Talent, so on and so forth, where instead of growing all together, they have open spaces and they have some buffer zones. That's what the whole process was on that. Then we took these three counties, Jackson, Josephine, and Douglas County, and did a pilot project on them. And what we did with those was because back in the early times of Senate Bill 100, the counties went and broad-brushed zoning, and they made EFU land in places where the only thing you can grow is rocks and black widows. No, nothing else. And they made that EFU land, which is erroneous, and with the intent to come back and do it later. But they never did come back and do it later. So that's what that process is. So I think this is kind of a combination of both is what it is, and I think it's a good step.
So I am going to, we're not going to delve into this right now because of all these other bills, but I am going to, towards the end of the hearing, ask DLCD to come up. And I wanted them to talk about those Southern Oregon regional counties project that Governor Kitzhaber authorized so they can explain what happened. And then also, you just reminded me of something, and since he's here, we'll ask him about this too. And when we did the Big Look bill, and I think it was a unanimous vote in about 2009, maybe, we allowed for remapping to be done on an expedited basis for all these erroneous parcels, but I don't really know what happened. So we'll have Jim talk about remapping, too.
On the regional pilot program,
yeah.
Two out of the three counties stuck together. One broke off.
That's what I kind of wanted to hear. I realized we did it. I know we even gave them more money at one point, yep, but then I wasn't sure if it really resulted in anything exactly.
One of them.
You all have different opinions down in Southern Oregon?
Yeah.
You're not monolithic?
Mr. Chair, I appreciate Representative Escobar's comments, and Nick's going to talk more about that, the different land that we're talking about. But I think the key thing here is that we already had a model that those three counties used, so we're going to copy that model when we study it again. And the fact is we're not asking for the state for any money. The counties want to, they'll have to eat the cost of doing the study themselves.
Yeah, that's different because I think we paid for it last
time. Yes, you did. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for stopping by this morning. We'll come back to House Bill 2222. And now, there we go. Let's get back to our carried over meeting. Sorry, folks, the other day who were here and we're making you come back. This is the solar on ag land bill again. So where we left off was we had a little bit of testimony in support. We had a couple gentlemen who were, I think, against, and now we're back to some support. Then we'll do against again. So Nick Giannettino?
Very good.
I think you were here the other day, too, so sorry for making you come all the way back.
Oh, no problem.
And I've got a Mr. or Mrs. Bear, is that a Jane Bear? Could you please join us? And we'll switch back to the not so much into this bill side after this.
Sure.
Okay.
Morning. Chair Klim, Vice Chair Springer, and Vice Chair McLean, and members of the committee. My name is Nick Giannettino. I'm a resident of Sheridan, Oregon. I came to testify in support of HB 3050, and to bring my perspective to this conversation as a rural Oregon resident, farmer, and someone who's been personally impacted by industrial solar development on Oregon's agricultural lands. During my 38-year employment with the U.S. Department of Agriculture, we lived in Oregon, Utah, Colorado, Montana, and several other locations across the country. I did everything from supervising national forests to working on national incident management teams who respond to wildland fires, hurricanes, and other emergencies. We returned to Oregon in 2008. And after a short stint in inner northeast Portland, we eventually found in 2010 the perfect place, 5 acres on the South Yamhill River, just west of Sheridan, with river frontage and irrigation rights. Nothing fancy, but a nice place in the country, surrounded by other farms, mostly 5 to 30 acres, along with a couple larger century farms, and exclusive farm use zoning all around. We had our space on our farm in retirement. And a great view of the upper south fork of the Yamhill River Valley. This comment is universal from everybody who comes to our house. A few years after that, a similar size farm was purchased about a half a mile west of us. Similar dreams from the purchaser. Small acreage on which to fulfill their lifelong dream of a Katahdin sheep farm. Also surrounded by EFU. An additional quality rural residence for those seeking a peaceful Oregon country living. Then last year, they were notified that the neighboring landowner had submitted an application to the county for a 12-acre commercial solar power generating facility, which was immediately east of their house. They were notified because they were within the state guidelines for notification. And they were only notified because the state guidelines required that proponents only have to let those neighboring property owners know of proposed development of solar power facilities when it is to be within 750 feet of their property. The county, of course, didn't do anything to increase this distance above the minimum requirement. As far as I can tell, in reviewing all the regulations related to this issue, the 750-foot notification provision is the only consideration that we have to address the adverse effects of these facilities on rural Oregon residents, just to notify them. We don't require proponents to address the adverse effect on rural residents' quality of life, nor what the responsibilities are of the company to maintain or clean up the development should they choose to leave, nor to address the adverse effects on rural residents' property values or any other effects on the rural residents who live near these proposed installations. The state must include some additional provisions in this process to require the proponent and the reviewing and deciding officials to address these real and profound effects on Oregon's rural residents. This notification distance is woefully inadequate and should be increased to a minimum of 1 mile. I was not notified, although I will be forced to have this affect me and the quality of my rural lifestyle for the rest of my life. This proposal, like many, is located on exclusive farm use, high-value farmland. As a result, we formed a neighborhood group, submitted comments in writing to the county planning staff, testified at hearings, and listed rational reasons why this made no sense to locate these kinds of improvements on rural Oregon high-value farmland. We wrote to the out-of-state development company, who had their local project representative provide some superficial responses. Surely the planning staff and county commissioners would not allow this incursion to disrupt the lifelong plans of our sheep farming neighbors by allowing the installation of a commercial power facility 50 feet from their property line. We attended a decision meeting, and to our disbelief, the proposal was approved by the county. We filed local appeal and attended the appeal meeting, and were equally or even more appalled when the original decision was upheld. The county's reply to our neighbors' concerns regarding visual impacts and possible long-term ramifications like maintenance and cleanup were to require a chain-link fence and planting vegetation, which is a rather urban technique, the kind of thing that we all moved to the country to get away from. They did, however, eventually, after our insistence, require a bond for removal of the facility at the end of its life, despite the argument from the proponent that showed a positive value for the facility removal and that it was unnecessary. The value has not been resolved, and there is no bond amount the last time I checked with the county last week. The county did not address our request to evaluate the cumulative effects on multiple resources, including visual resources and view sheds, the quality of rural lifestyle of rural residents, the effects on farmland and particularly high-value farmland, and the cumulative effects from the loss of productivity from farmlands for the service life of these installations. The Yamhill County Soil and Water Conservation District provided written comments on this proposal, and the district's rough calculation showed that given the currently approved criteria for commercial solar power generating facilities located on agricultural lands, that the county could lose up to 2.5% of agricultural lands in any given region. These losses can be increased further if secondary provisions in the existing criteria are followed, as these provisions allow additional power approvals if a proposed project, quote, does not materially alter the stability of the overall use pattern of the area. The County Soil and Water Conservation District is concerned about the real and viable threat that commercial solar power generating facilities pose to high-value soils and agricultural lands. The proponent also presented a paper from a realtor, I believe, in North Carolina, showing no change in property values due to the installation of these facilities. Do you believe this? I don't. Do you want one of these installations next to your house? I don't. I don't think anyone does. The two property owners who leased land to these developers did not locate them next to their personal residences, but long distances out of sight of where they live. So given that, we could always appeal to Land Use Board of Appeals, and this course of action was pursued until the required professional legal representation proved to be prohibitively expensive. Of course, the proponents know this. They can afford professional legal representation. They are not your rural, average Oregon resident. They are financially well off. They do this for a living. So now our neighbors are waiting to be saddled with the construction of this facility, which they will have to look at each and every day in scenic rural Oregon. Why is this allowed? Most people don't normally associate rural Oregon with solar power generation. Studies have shown, in fact, that it is the worst area of the state for solar power generation, with southwest Oregon, central, and eastern Oregon being much better. So why do we have such interest here? Possibly it could be due in part to a favorable regulatory environment. Revenue generation for solar power is much more favorable for counties compared to revenue from farming. My farm deferral taxes are a little over $25 per acre per year. The current regulations allow for paying many multiples of this in lieu of taxes per year for solar installations. In addition, permit fees for the county are favorable. The latest proposal on Yamhill County had fees over $5,500 associated with the application process, so it's good for the counties. The landowner also does well. They receive an average rental for not farming, not incurring expenses in labor, and basically more money for doing no work.
And Nick, we have to have you conclude. We've got a whole lot of other people
I understand.
Other topics.
Okay, so what I'll do is I'll skip the rest of this, which you can read at your... The other thing I may ask is if I could take part of my partner's time.
As long as she's okay with it.
Okay. Yes,
I don't want her to bop you.
Okay. Thank you, sir. That's important that we hear the rest of this. So the companies do well, too, paying annual rent with the landowner, but more importantly, they provide an opportunity for wealthy investors to be guaranteed a steady stream of cash flow and receive tax benefits to make them even wealthier based upon the uninterrupted revenue stream it receives from the utility company for a long time period, in most instances a minimum of 20 years. So many of the proponents are out-of-state companies financed by large, wealthy, other out-of-state investment companies. Their claims are they're selling cheap renewable power, but if one digs deeper, they are selling investments. Investments that allow reaping the benefits from these proposals while paying none of the adverse costs associated with the operations. They are miles, hundreds of miles, or thousands of miles removed from these adverse effects. So in addition to this project immediately adjacent to our neighbor's house, 1/2 mile west of our residence, there's an existing solar installation 3 miles southwest of my house along Highway 18, which you may have seen on the way to Grand Ronde. A proposal for a 12-acre installation 1.4 miles southeast of our house along Ballston Road, south of Sheridan. Two separate installations less than 9 miles east of the house along Bellevue Road. And a proposed 45-acre installation less than 1 mile north of my house, centered in the Yamhill River Valley viewshed that all the visitors to our house marvel about. This view and viewshed will be permanently destroyed if this proposal is approved. And as far as I can tell, no proposal has ever been refused if submitted to the county for review. So that's why we need your help in addressing this issue.
Carried over the work session next week.
Oregon officials could not possibly have foreseen the explosive growth in this program and the scope of individual and cumulative effects associated with these installations when these regulations were first enacted. While many people understand the need to reduce fossil fuel consumption and associated greenhouse gas emissions, many of us are now personally aware and being forced to live with the cost of such installations in, of all places, agricultural rural Oregon. It is reasonable and prudent that we pause now to reevaluate these effects. So how do we solve it? HB 3050, that's a start. But in looking at watershed-related events, which has the biggest impact for potential? If you have a problem in the headwaters, delta, or mainstream, fixing the issues in the headwaters has the best effect for system-wide improvement. So let's look at the state agricultural policy, which is really the headwaters for agricultural land use in Oregon to help. Established, as you know, in 1973 and codified in 215, 243. There's four elements. I'll hit the highlights. You guys know.
Actually, just hold on.
Okay.
So you've already wiped out her time, too. So
okay,
you
well,
really
sorry.
Have, like, maybe 30 seconds
okay.
left.
I can do that in 30 seconds.
Okay, because okay. we have a lot of people here on other
yes,
topics.
I understand that, and forgive me yeah. for taking
I,
and, so long.
I made you come back, so I'm giving you a lot of latitude, but we got to okay. close it up here.
So the proposal is this, that the legislature work with the Department of Land Conservation Development and any other state departments and agencies as necessary to issue a moratorium on the construction and installation of any approved but not yet constructed solar power generating facilities on Oregon farmland and to prevent the approval of any new proposals for solar facilities until the record can be opened and additional public comment and revision of the regulations to this issue happens. And we need to do this because the county felt they're in a tough spot with what we have. And address the issues in this hearing, including the individual and cumulative effects of commercial solar power generating facilities on Oregon farmland, including effects on adjacent property values, visual resources and view sheds, quality of life of rural residents, farmland and particularly high value farmland, fragmentation, and the irreversible effects on the loss of productivity from these lands for the service life. And change the regulations to require residents within 1 mile be notified. Change the regulations so no facility will be allowed within 1/2 mile of an existing Oregon rural residence. And to deal with some of the environmental justice issues related to these proposals, since most of the proponents don't live here and their incomes are much higher than the local residents. The proponent for the latest 45-acre array north of Sheridan has an estimated income of $225,000, while the residents in Sheridan
okay.
is
yeah.
$37,000 like with 20%.
3 seconds.
20% of the population below the poverty level. So we'd ask you that you look at those.
Okay. Thank you so much.
I can be very brief.
Really brief, yeah.
Yeah. You have my written testimony in your file. I would just refer you to the attachment I brought in this morning, which is the graph from the PGE website showing the production of solar energy from the 12-acre Willamina solar array from January 2016, when it came online, through March 2017. I think you'll see it's very clear and evident that the amount of power that is being generated from these sites in the western Willamette Valley is not consistent. Obviously, we don't get a lot of sun, and we're losing all this high-value farmland to something that really could be located somewhere else and
be
more profitable.
Okay, thank you so much for coming down. Let me switch back to the other side here. Jeff Bissonette, Nels Johnson.
Thank you.
Marianne, didn't I have you talk the other day?
I didn't know if you wanted me again. I'm happy to stand down.
Yeah, probably, just because we've got a bunch of other things. Thank you. Okay, gentlemen, welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Bissonette, representing the Oregon Solar Energy Industries Association. I'll be very brief in recognition of other things you have on your agenda. OSEA is the Solar Trade Association for the state, and while we recognize that there may be concerns because of more interest in siting and developing large-scale solar, some of that is being driven, one, by the cost of solar coming down, and so particularly in large solar developments, those resources are really getting cost competitive with more traditional sources of power. And so that is of interest to some developers. Also, with our increased renewable energy standards by the legislature last year, again, there's additional opportunity. I think that because of that and because of the dynamic nature of the industry, we're certainly open to a discussion. Until sometime late last fall, we weren't really aware that the current restrictions weren't working, and so we're open to that conversation. But I think this bill is a little bit premature because, frankly, I'm not quite sure what problem we're solving or what the solution to any problem is. So we would ask that you send parties to, you know, talk about this, really get an understanding on both sides of the issues that are at stake, and then possibly come back with a more developed issue. I would also commend to you, some of you had to leave kind of toward the end of the hearing on Tuesday, but there was a land use attorney, Mr. Hall from Baljanic, that submitted testimony. I commend that testimony to you if you weren't able to hear it in person. Also, some landowners who have cited solar and have found it to be a fruitful and invasive part of their farming operation. With that, I'll conclude and happy to answer any questions.
Dallas, go ahead.
Great, thank you. Good morning, Chair Clem, members of the committee. My name is Nels Johnson. I'm here on behalf of Renewable Northwest this morning. Renewable Northwest is an organization with a diverse membership that's dedicated to responsible development of renewable energy resources in Oregon throughout the Pacific Northwest. And we're here today in opposition to House Bill 3050. The bill would effectively only allow solar projects on high-value farmland if an alternative site study is conducted and there's no other site available with lesser soils to site the project. This is highly problematic, specifically for PGE service territory, as a high percentage of their service territory is high-value farmland. This introduced criteria is open to a lot of subjectivity, which is going to, I think, it runs the risk of running up the cost of projects, making, we've done a lot of good work in the last decade of really bringing down the cost curve of solar, and my fear is that something like this may undo some of that work. And so, though we are open to having a conversation about this, I think I just I'll wrap up by echoing Mr. Bissonnette's comments that A, we think this is premature, and B, we didn't know this was a problem. And so I guess we would just ask that we have a clear definition of what is the problem that we're trying to solve, and why is this the best solution. So with that, happy to take any questions you may have. Thank you.
Questions? One I've got that has just dawned on me. When we're talking about the land zoning, I wouldn't call it overlay, but high-value farmland, which isn't exactly a zone, EFU's a zone, high-value farmland is a definition of within the EFU zone certain types of farmland. Are we talking in these discussions and in this bill about on the land, or are we also talking about on top of the buildings? Because I will tell you, just to give you a little bit of feedback, Nels, in terms of what are we trying to solve, I think for some of us, it's I don't want good farmland that's used for food used for solar. I don't. I want it on rocky stuff. I want it in Eastern Oregon. The food land should be for food because you can eat food. You can't eat solar. You need utilities, obviously, but it's better when it's something that's in the air. It minimizes disruption of good soil. So that's the problem I think we're trying to deal with. But I don't care if it's on the top of buildings, even on high-value farmland, as long as it's on the buildings, not wiping out a whole bunch of crops. But now that I think about it, I don't know if we differentiate in these bills between on top of buildings or land.
Mr. Chair, thank you for raising that, because it had occurred to me after my comments that Mr. Hall, the land use attorney who was here on Tuesday, actually specifically said to me, one thing I didn't say, and if you could, when you come back, and I forgot until just now, that it wasn't clear to him whether or not it was being, you know, on barns or on buildings or just on the land. And so that was, you know, that was one of the concerns that he had. I will also say that, Mr. Dozler, who was here on Tuesday as well and talked about his experience as a landowner with solar on his property, what the experience is that a landowner will look at their property and say, you know, over in this part, there's not a lot happening with it. It's either, you know, it's classified as high-value farmland, but it really isn't. There's nothing really that's growing on it. That'd be a good place to put solar, or it's a better, higher use within the farming operation. And so landowners do kind of make that distinction within that, within that property, within the current restrictions that are in place. I can go into that deeper, but just those are the immediate answers to your two questions.
Okay. And Vice Chair Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sitting here debating if I have something to say or not. As I look at this bill, to me the problem that we're trying to solve, or that the bill attempts to solve, is fairly obvious, at least to me, which is the high-value land. And I'm not against people making money, of course, but I do have the same concern as far as a food crop, number one. And I'm thinking, we and our family just took our first little path into solar panel about this big to operate the automatic gate opener that we have, because my husband didn't want to trench 75 yards. That was it. And through rock and shale. And we have a hard time keeping it charged. We really do. And we have two batteries, and it's not under a canopy. We're having a really hard time keeping it charged right now. So I hate the idea of pulling food production, something out of food production, for a minimally successful solar. Now, I'm sure that people would plan their solar panels in a better way than we did, but you put a gate where the driveway is. So I think that's the problem that's trying to be solved. Is this the best way to use this land? And if it's on top of a barn that's already there, fine. But if it's pulling anything out of production, and I'm not a farmer, but it's pretty apparent to any of us that are around farms, the less production, the lesser producing land is usually on the edges near the trees. So I'm thinking that isn't going to translate to a good solar place. And I'm afraid it's going to be in the middle of that field.
I think the thing, I do think we need to talk more about this as we talk to my office, but I will say I can see scenarios where, because farmland is intentionally by state policy designed to be kept relatively cheap compared to inside the UGB land, we want it cheap so farmers can afford to do it. You could get people who aren't really farmers who just buy farmland to use for other means. And so then it comes back to the legislature, what do you allow on farmland? And if one of them is something that is a lot more attractive to do than farming, and they're not farmers, they won't factor in, hey, what's the best part of my farm? They'll just use the whole thing for it. And I'm not as worried about that, honestly, way out in eastern Oregon, but I am pretty worried about it in the Willamette Valley in particular, where non-farmers buy farmland because it's only 10 or 15 grand an acre, and really they should probably be going to Portland and figuring out how to put it on top of every building, and everyone would be happy. Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to let you know that we do have high-value farmland over in eastern Oregon, too.
Yeah. If it's got water, I know. It's much better. And actually, the other comment I was going to make, we're about to get into a whole issue about the definition of high-value farmland with Rep. Brock Smith and I have been talking about for about the last month. This committee will get it here pretty quick. Does the fact that you once applied for a water right and never even finished or perfected it really make you high value farmland? But technically in the law it does, but we're about to have a bill to deal with that too here. So to Nels, I think to your point about subjectivity, I think high value farmland is actually fairly specifically defined and probably a little bit tight in some areas. And we're going to, I think, have another discussion in here about high value farmland with Representative Greg Smith here in a little bit, because when we wrote Measure 49 to stop down Mr. Chandler's wildest dreams, we did define very heavily viticultural areas, and some of them are called high-value farmland, but I think if they don't have water and they don't have any grapes, there's some people debating whether that's completely necessary to be that tight. I forget the name of the viticulture area out there, but we're going to hear about that too. So I think there's a larger issue here that we could probably discuss with you all.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, just very quickly, I think you're right. I mean, I'm personally very interested in having more in-depth discussion about how to align Oregon's land use policy and renewable energy development, particularly solar, because those are two, I think, you know, land use is a long time iconic Oregonian value, and renewable energy is kind of a newer one, but getting to be just as iconic. And I think we have to figure out how those two live together. I will point out, though, that, you know, it's not sort of the Wild West out there in the Willamette Valley or high-value farmland. I mean, there are restrictions. There are processes that developers have to go through, and, you know, they're not insignificant. And also, too, there is a limitation in, you know, the Willamette Valley in particular of, you know, the maximum of 12 acres. And, you know, so that does limit the size in eastern Oregon, high-value farmland out there notwithstanding. You know, you can put larger systems out there. So it's kind of a mix, you know, in a portfolio. One of the advantages, you know, there's some discussion about the resource value. The resource value isn't ideal, but it's decent in the Willamette Valley, enough to have a power production facility. One ideal thing that it does have is that it is close to transmission and is close to load.
I was going to ask about that. How does the grid really this is going to be a long conversation. I can take this offline.
You don't want to go there. Yeah. I'm happy to go in.
But I was curious, you know, does distance to certain things make a difference?
Yeah, it does. And that is why you want to have, you know, some, you know, closer to load, some that's further away that has a better output, but it costs more to get it to the load. And, you know, that's kind of the ongoing game of utilities to balance all those interests. But those are the discussions that we need to have. And so, you know, let's take some time to have them and sort of nail down just, you know, what the concerns are and how we best address them.
Okay, anything else for these gentlemen? Okay, thank you very much. Marianne, I'm going to hold off on having you come back up on the phone. Let's talk amongst ourselves and get to our next batch of people who are here, like Representative Lanier. So let me close the public hearing, House Bill 3050. Let me open a public hearing on House Bill 3012. Colleagues, we've got like four different things all dealing with sort of similar topics. So they're all grouped together, but they're distinct enough that I'm probably not going to just open them all at once for at least Rep. Lanier, because you probably just want to talk about the one, don't you? Yeah, so why don't you join us, Representative, and let's talk about 3012 first. Roughly, the topic is accessory dwelling units and rural living, generally, for all these bills.
Right. Thank you, Chair Clem and members of the committee. I'm Ann Leininger, State Representative for House District 38, which is Lake Oswego and Southwest Portland. And I'm here today in support of House Bill 3012, which we brought forward in the Housing and Human Services Committee with a noteworthy team of supporters that included 1,000 Friends of Oregon, the Farm Bureau, the Oregon Realtors Association, and the Home Builders Association.
Whoa. That's not normal.
It doesn't always happen. What this bill would do is both help address our access to affordable housing issue and help address the need to preserve historic structures on rural residential land. It very intentionally does not touch EFU land, exclusive farm use land, but rather rural residential. And this concept was brought to me by former Clackamas County Chair when I was a county commissioner and well-known advocate for the protection of farmland and also a very committed preservationist of historic structures. Her family's been here for a zillion years, and she has really focused a lot of her energy on preserving historic structures. So what this bill would do is it would say that on rural residential land, when an owner owns 2 acres or more, And sometimes it happens that an owner will buy a parcel of rural residential land with the intention of building sort of a dream home on it. But on the land already is some sort of modest historic structure, maybe a 1,000 square foot or a 1,200 square foot older home. And this bill encompasses those built between 1850 and 1945. Under current law, in order for the landowner to be able to build their new dream home, they must deconstruct or in some other way essentially waste the existing home structure, turn it into a chicken coop, something like that, because they can only have on their land one dwelling. And what this bill would say is you don't have to waste that smaller, more modest structure. You can build your dream home if you have more than 2 acres, and you can continue to have that home. You may not parcelize the land and sell that home, but you may rent it out. You may put money in to fix it up, to keep it intact, and you may rent it out. But you certainly, it would not contribute to the further parcelization of rural residential land by enabling people to sell it off to different owners. This bill has incorporated additional protections at the suggestion of the Association of Planning Directors, Oregon chapter, and at the suggestion of Association of Oregon Counties. And those additions are in the Dash 1 amendment, and they are as follows. The ADU must comply with all applicable laws, including, you know, DEQ and local laws related to sanitation and wastewater disposal and treatment. The owner may not construct a second ADU on the land. The county, this is a permissive use by counties. Counties can choose not to allow this. The county may require the single family residence to be served, the dream home to be served by the same water source as the current home. And the county may impose additional covenants on the construction of the new single family home that they see fit. And we also narrowed the scope from the original bill of the historic structures that would potentially be allowed to be preserved under this from the span of 1850 to 1950 to the span of 1850 to 1945, which some people perceived was an important delineation. So this is very distinct from the other ADU bills that you have before you that warrant consideration, absolutely. We've worked very actively with Farm Bureau, Thousand Friends, realtors, and home builders in the hope of trying to craft something that everyone could get behind that would help address affordable housing needs by sort of lifting some of the restrictions that landowners face as one of a series of tools. Some of the tools that we're looking at include imposing additional restrictions. So this one was hoping to do the counterintuitive play of helping address the issue in our rural areas, which absolutely also face affordable housing shortage by not mandating the waste of existing structures. So I hope you will look on it favorably. I believe it still has the support of all of those groups. Restore, which is a preservation group focused on historic structures, supported the original version. We haven't heard back on this version, but I would be shocked if they no longer support it. So that's what I've got, and I would welcome any questions.
Let's start with Vice Chair McLean, then we'll come to Vice Chair Springer.
Representative, one of the comments that you made was that the counties had asked to be able to put on anything else that they deemed to be important. I think those were your words, but what kind of things? Do we have an idea?
You know, I think what my notes here say, and I don't know if there's someone from AOC in the room, counties, this is a permissive thing to allow. So counties, in the way that they may condition activities subject to time, place, and manner restrictions that are appropriate, would have the ability to impose additional conditions for approval of construction that they deemed appropriate.
Okay.
And did you have something?
Yeah.
Vice Chair Springer, and then we'll come to Rep. Brock Smith.
Thank you. So thank you, Mr. Chair. As I walk through the last part of this bill, the accessory dwelling is the existing historic dwelling.
Right.
And so, and sometimes those are small, like you said, and sometimes those are huge. They're quite large, two stories, and would take a lot of money to restore.
Okay.
But as I look at this, it says here at the very end, you may not alter, renovate, or remodel the accessory dwelling unit so that the square footage of the accessory dwelling is more than 120% of the square footage. So you can build your new home any size that you want, and it's probably going to be fairly large. And then you can renovate or remodel that existing home to be 120% the size of this home. So you could theoretically end up with two very large homes on this 2 or more acre parcel. Certainly, we would be counting on the county's restrictions on water and sewer and driveways, even. Driveways have to be permitted. I just want us to realize we could be talking about two very large homes on a fairly small piece of land.
Well,
if my interpretation is correct.
Mr. Chair, Representative Springer, I appreciate that comment. My understanding of the issue is that a lot of the historic structures that would potentially be subject to this are things like a 1,000 square foot home that might have two bedrooms and one bathroom, or a 1,200 square foot home. And the vision here in allowing up to 120%, you know, improvements that could occupy up to 120% of the square footage was that if someone needed to add, you know, an additional bathroom in order to make it more usable in today's families, that the bill was not intended to prohibit that. So my understanding is that for the great majority of structures, we're talking about modest old homes that could be outfitted to be a little bit more usable, but probably still quite affordable for families that are seeking rental housing. And again, it can't be sold. So this is only a rental capacity. And if a local community wanted to put restrictions on, for example, that you can't use it for Airbnb, they absolutely could. But that would be a local control decision for them to make.
Just brief follow-up. Thank you for that. I appreciate that. And that's probably the majority of the homes. But I just want us to be aware that the language does provide for two pretty large homes, potentially,
on a
small lot.
Okay.
Representative Brock Smith and Rep. Barreto.
Thank you. So before I left the county, we did something similar with regards to accessory dwelling units. And what this allows, especially in my rural neck of the woods, is kind of a mother-in-law cottage. A lot of folks are in situations where they want to come up and they want to take care of their parents, but their home, you know, they don't want to live in their mother's home, and they have the means and the ability to build on the property, and the mother wants to stay in her own home, and so this allows that ability to take care of your parents, really, without having to have other folks come in. So appreciate the bill.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A creative idea. The question is, in the historic home, that does it remain a single family dwelling, or can it be remodeled into a duplex or a fourplex or whatever?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barreto, my understanding is that it would be a single family home and that you couldn't increase by more than 120% the usable square footage. So it's not that the footprint, my understanding is, it's not that the footprint is constrained at 120%, but you could go up, and somehow make it into a multifamily. Rather, that it was intended to allow for the situation where a really modest house needs to be outfitted to be a little bit more usable by today's standards. But certainly, the local community could, in accordance with the provisions that allow local communities to do this permissively and to add additional conditions on the construction of the
property could make it clear if you feel like there's ambiguity on that, or if you wanted an amendment on that, I would absolutely support that. I think the intent is to honor the historic dwellings' nature. You know, when former county chair, now city councilor in Wilsonville, Charlotte Lehan, brought me this idea, her animating purpose was to protect old historic Oregon structures in rural areas, and we originally looked at including EFU land because, of course, you know, there are historic structures on EFU land and rural residential. But then as we tried to build consensus among a wide range of partners, it became clear that EFU land is its own, you know, has a lot of attendant concerns that are legitimate. So we lopped that off. So it's only rural residential, and the intent is to protect the historic nature of structures. So that would, you know, making it into a multifamily dwelling, a duplex, would absolutely thwart that intent. But I am the one who, in light of our housing crisis and the need to provide access not just in urban areas but in rural areas, saw this as an opportunity to also, by not mandating the waste of these structures, open up through a little bit backed off government regulation the opportunity for additional housing to be created. So I think the clear intent is just preservation of the nature of and the existence of these historic homes, an incidental benefit to which, in my view, is that it provides more affordable housing, because if you're adding the dream home and you still got this thing, then you've ended up netting some housing. Does that give you enough answer? Yeah, and if you needed amendment, I'd be fine with that.
Yeah, it does. I think when you started out, your introduction, it had to do with affordable housing. And so then if you take this and say, well, no, only one family, or if it's a big one of these larger, older farmhouses, you know, then a lot of those easily could be turned into a duplex. So that was just my question.
Okay. So thank you.
Okay.
Any further, Representative Langer?
Okay, we'll move on to... Thank you,
thank
Representative.
You.
Let's, we have two more on this one. Mary Kyle and Peggy Lynch, would you like to come up and potentially give your encore presentation from the Housing Committee of Kumbaya?
Good morning, Chair Clem, members of the committee. Mary Kyle McCurdy, representing 1000 Women of Oregon. I'm Representative Leininger, approached us early on about this bill, and we have worked with her to support it because of its narrow application to historic homes. And as you'll find out, we're not supportive of some of the other bills that will be before you on housing in rural areas, but this is aimed at protecting historic homes. And Representative Leininger's office has worked with us to narrow that time span so that it's through World War II, and to add some of the other things that you heard Representative Leininger talk about in terms of sharing the same septic and water systems, that there's an ownership requirement, that counties can choose to not do this at all or to condition it. Those amendments I have yet to see drafted, but we've discussed those in concept, and Representative Leininger has spoken to you about them. I believe in answer to Representative Springer's question about the square footage issue, I think the 120% is of that historic structure. It's 120% of the historic structure, I hope, and not the 120% of the new home that would be built. What's appealing about, and if it's, I hope it's what I just said and not what you were thinking. So under 20% of the historic structure, right? It could still be big if that existing historic structure was larger. And key to this is that the owner has to restore the historic structure, presumably consistent with its historic nature. And so those are the sorts of things that we expect to see in the amendment. Thank you.
Peggy Lynch, League of Women Voters of Oregon. I have provided you with a map of the groundwater restricted areas in Oregon. And the reason I have done that is that in this bill, as well as the bills that you will be talking about related to ADUs later, I have really focused on the wells and septics issue around adding an additional unit in rural residential areas. We are, with this particular bill, we've seen the proposed amendments. We do appreciate the fact that the bill is now permissive and allows counties to, and they could do a restriction, for instance, to have only those houses that are in their county's historical register or in their county's inventory. We're concerned about the breadth of the number of homes and what's really historical and what's not, and it's really not defined other than the age of the home in this particular bill. So that's a concern. If the home requires a second septic, that could be problematic as far as the amount of land needed for septic and needed for drain fields, et cetera. I want to share with you, and then you won't have to hear this the second time around with the other bills, but I do want to, it is important. Over 30% of Oregonians rely on septic systems, and this was back in 2009, and about 1% are failing right now. That works out to 4,600 systems each year that are failing. There is, once the septic system is in, there is no second requirement to have it checked to be sure that it's working unless somebody notices that it's failed. There is just no second opportunity. There is no second opportunity related to wells. As a matter of fact, wells, exempt wells, and this is what this is about, are exempt wells, actually get a free pass. They just get to have a start card, and the well contractor gets to drill. In 2008, 2009, there were 230,000 exempt wells, and they never get checked. So you don't even know if you've got enough water. You don't know whether the water is contaminated. So those are very real rural issues that we have worked on. And what's concerning to me with this map, and the reason I bring this to you, is the linkage between water rights that people actually have, that they have perfected, that they have spent money on to make happen, and exempt wells, which don't count. So in the Umatilla Basin, for instance, in that red area, many of the water rights owners are not...
So just one second. So I've got you multiple times. Are you doing it all right now? Because this isn't seemingly about just this bill.
Well, it is about this bill.
But it's about all the bills.
It's the same issue.
I know. That's okay. I just want to... Can I take you off the other ones if you do it all
sure.
now? Yes. Thank you.
I couldn't figure out how to
I like hearing
otherwise.
From you, but I'm going to give you a total like 10 minutes, I've got you for like 40 right now.
That's correct. Point. Be more than happy to do that, because you are hearing the same issue.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
It is pretty much the same issue.
Okay.
It is really important to understand that the farmers, the agricultural interests, get taken off of their usage in these areas, but exempt wells get to continue to suck the water. And you're asking for a second straw with an ADU in these areas. And so I appreciate the fact that this may be of a lesser impact than the other bills. So I do understand that. I want to make some other points, since that's the case. In the other bills, there are definitions around accessory dwelling units and rural residential that are being considered. And if that's the case, those definitions ought to go in this bill as well, if you choose to move this bill, because it would be important to make sure that you're using the same definition throughout legislation. I think those are the main points that I have as far as the other bills are concerned. We have more concerns about them because it's a broader opportunity to add additional units. And they are not affordable housing, respectfully. By the time you take care of dealing with making sure that you have the septic and you have the wells and that you take care of whatever permitting is required, we are simply talking about adding another unit in a rural residential home. So be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for these two? Okay, Peggy, I will just say that we already had this conversation once. We don't have to have it all over again. But I will say, I think even though there isn't necessarily a governmental person to say that there's no more water or the septic is overflowing, I think the property owners usually know if their water is gone or if their yard smells horrible. and they kind of call somebody to deal with it usually.
Respectfully, Chair Clem, I talked to septic people who recently, because I was dealing with some water fees, and they say that 5 years later, they finally get around to taking care of it. So they figure that if they have somebody that's got a problem, by the time the people actually want to deal with the issue because of the cost, it's sometimes up to 5 years before it does. So, but anyway, I do get the idea that you think that that's the case. Lots of people don't even know they have a failing septic.
Yeah, I guess I was thinking more like if the septic's full and backing up into your house, you call the guy to come pump it. If your well is not working at all and you can't get any water, you think, something's wrong, and you call somebody. Failing, you might not know because it's under the ground, right?
That's exactly correct, and it actually does contaminate the nearby water. And the wells are not tested for any kinds of contaminants. We have lots of – there's another bill in this session.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think there's another bill on that
topic. The Safe Water Bill to try to get water wells tested.
It wouldn't apply to this.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And – we have another legislator here, so why don't we... Actually, that's it on 3012 for testimony, so let me close the public hearing on 3012. And, Rep. Lanier. That's what she's waving at me, too. Why don't you come on up? I have you also on many other bills, so I was going to try and fold you in. But
30 seconds.
Okay, yes.
I just didn't want to create any confusion. Chair Clem, members of the committee, Mary Ann Nash, the Oregon Farm Bureau, we just, as we said in the last hearing on this, wanted to say we appreciate Representative Leniger working with us on this bill and getting it to something that we can all agree to.
Nice.
Wow. I'll be that brief. Thank you.
That is great. Let's close the public hearing on House Bill 3012. Let me open a public hearing on House Bill 2456 and ask Representative Parrish to join us. Then we'll go on to the other two after this one. Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Clem, members of the committee, for the record, Julie Parrish, House District 37, Westland and Tualatin, and bringing you House Bill 2456. So 4 of my years in this legislature have been serving on the Housing and Human Service Committee. So we're bringing you housing bills. And philosophically, where I land on housing issues and having served on the ABC Housing Task Force with Representative Reardon in our interim, trying to come up with some ideas like this to address housing, is that housing is not one size fits all, and the policies that we have need to address the demographics of who we're trying to serve with housing. And in this particular case, House Bill 2456 is about giving a land use exemption for churches and nonprofits to site in rural residential low-income housing rentals. If you look, there is a median income requirement in terms of how much they can charge per county. That will vary by county. But in my community, what this looks like is I have a lot of mega churches sitting out on lots of acres, surrounded right in that sort of urban metro area, very near, within a few minutes of Coffee Creek Women's Prison, where I'd like to spend some time. And one of the biggest things I hear is about transitional housing, people coming out of the justice system. So when you think about a church, and I've got a couple in my community that also operate our food banks, they operate emergency, emergency rental, type vouchers, they have land. They have the ability to put units on their property, and some of the pastors in my community are interested in this idea. However, our land use laws say we can't do that. And so we're asking for a solution, and this bill does say that counties will allow this type of use. And you will probably hear from counties to say that they would like to be able to opt into this kind of use. Well, we passed a bill the other day on the floor asking cities to do things with affordable housing, and we knew that that would come with a fiscal. So you'll hear counties potentially say that there would be a fiscal for them to have a process for this. But the fact is I think our government is culpable for the housing crisis that we're in. When we say no and we have arbitrary laws that say we can or can't do XYZ with property in order to build, it creates the housing crisis. When a half an acre of dirt or a quarter acre of dirt in my community sells for $500,000, you're not building anything affordable right outside the metro area. So this type of housing for me, and I'm thinking one church in particular that is sited across the street from some of the best schools in the state, and has acres and acres and acres of empty land, but they're a church. To me, it would make sense that if you had a mom who's got kids and they're leaving a domestic violence situation, that there's a unit there for them to stay on. If you've got people coming out of the justice system, if you have people coming out of, homeless veterans. And I appreciate when people come to my office to tell me why they don't like these bills, they say things like, the law says we can't. Last time I checked, we all have a little button, I'm not wearing mine today, that says we get to change the laws. And that in our state constitution, it says that, basically, paraphrasing, that the legislature of 1 year gone past cannot bind our hands in moving forward. And so when people say, this is the law, Senate Bill 100 is the law, there's a lot of laws we don't like, and we do change them. And I'm always willing to, have those conversations. We've heard in other committees things like, voters didn't get a chance to, we want to change the law on the death penalty, and you hear voters voted. Well, you know what? Let voters vote again. I'm not opposed to that. And so we do need to be prospective in looking at how we deal with our laws. Our Constitution allows us to change the laws and think fluidly about new situations. And, and you hear Governor McCall, and he's revered on land use. I think he would roll in his grave if he knew that there were people parked on the side of our freeways in their RVs or wherever because we have nowhere to site them and that there's homelessness. And I'm sure that the five people who died in Portland this year as they were freezing their asses off were absolutely comforted by the fact, as they were dying in the cold, that we have this wonderful land use system that does not allow for this type of housing. So, yeah, I'm asking counties to actually say we're going to do this, and I'm asking this body to say, yeah, we're going to tell you to do it and have a process to do it because it's the right thing to do, colleagues. I've actually experienced homelessness. It is not fun. These types of units are absolutely important, and I will just say that if we are not going to deal with housing on the supply side, we need 80,000 units in the metro area. They don't all need to be an apartment. They don't all need to be a traditional site-built home. Some of those housing units are for people with real need. This bill helps give us there. Will it house everybody? No. But I think we need to look at demographically, how do we solve the housing issue? And there are lots of supply-side things that deal with just specific populations, senior housing, veteran housing, domestic violence housing, and we have to treat them all differently because housing a mom with children is different than trying to get a homeless veteran in off the streets. So I would, great, you're going to hear testimony from all kinds of people who say why we can't do things, but after 7 years, this is my seventh year in the building, of listening to people say we can't do these types of bills, our housing crisis isn't going away, and we aren't building new units fast enough to solve it. So I would urge you to think about that, as we have still 3 months to solve housing issues, or at least do something to put more in the mix this year, and I'm still waiting for a supply-side bill to move off our floor, colleagues. Thank you.
Okay, questions? Vice Chair McLean, then Representative Flint.
Well, first of all, I love your can-do attitude, and I agree with you. We've got to think about how to do things, not that we can't do things. But in Forest Grove right now, we actually have a couple of churches that are thinking about, doing some housing on their site, and they have a whole block.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a situation, though, that they're one block away from the bus line. They're not very far from downtown Forest Grove. So I was wondering what you were thinking about the rural residential churches, because I went to one, Maxburg Lutheran Church, outside of Molalla and Canby. But they would not, if it was affordable housing and they didn't have a car or they didn't have, a way to get around, that might be not the best place for them. So I was wondering what you were thinking mm-hmm. about some of those other area and other issues that we have to take into consideration about where's a good place to actually put affordable housing.
Thank you, Chairman, Vice Chair McLean. I think that's an important question. For the people who are sleeping in their cars, I think they could probably get to a unit like this. Some of the churches in my community are not on a bus line, but they're very near a bus line. And one of the kind of innovative things that's happening in transportation in my district is that we have Mary's Woods. They're a nursing-type facility and a retirement-type facility. And they have a worked-out out a deal with TriMet, for example, where we don't have a lot of good cross suburban transportation. So they are using their sort of senior bus that says Mary's Woods on it, and they're running a loop through our community, and they're providing an alternative form of transportation in the community. So I see an opportunity to partner with organizations like that. Right up the road from some of these churches is a very nice retirement community, you know, that also has that type of busing. So if we were to get a land use exemption and some of the churches in our communities would want to do this, I'm going to go have that conversation with organizations like that in the community to see if we can't extend that type of transportation service. Because otherwise, about 3 minutes down the road by car are jobs in Tualatin. The freeway's right there. I mean, we're in the metro area, really, when all's said and done. And our rural residential isn't that rural anymore, right? It's right there, and you can get to, you know, the city in a stone's throw. So so I think those types of issues will be addressed. And obviously, like I said, in terms of people who might be sited in one of these units, should they be built, who have children, you know, the school bus lines are going to run right there and get kids to school. So so I'm a little less concerned about that in the metro area.
Okay, Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I acknowledge that there are a variety of ways of addressing the housing problem, and true confessions, I would admit to possibly having been daydreaming here for a moment, but I would swear that I heard the representative say early in her testimony that she would like to spend some time at Coffee Creek Women's Correctional Facility, and I was just wondering how long a period of time she had in mind.
Depends on how the end of the session turns out.
Signy die tape. Put that on signy die tape.
Representative Witt, when I'm asked to go to Coffee Creek to visit with women who are there, having had a sister who was a resident there once, that is definitely a near and dear to my heart. And when they ask, I show up. They do a program called Through a Child's Eyes, where they have a carnival inside the walls for children, and they bring families in over the weekend, and women who are been in the, like, maximum security, who don't get a chance to really connect with, yes, their children. They do some pretty innovative things out there. And transitional housing for our prison population. We know we've had ban-the-box conversations and all manner of things about how do you support recidivism. Housing is the number one reason. You know, when my sister died, she died in a homeless shelter. So to me, housing is just, it's a personal, visceral thing. And these types of bills, while they won't solve all of the housing crisis, they solve it for the people they are serving in the moment that they're serving them.
Good on you, Representative.
Okay, Brock Smith, question for the representative.
Thank you, Representative, for bringing this bill. Section 2, subsection 2. No, excuse me, subsection 3. My apologies. Over a county with land use jurisdiction over rural residential land shall develop a process by which qualifying landowners may apply to the county to develop affordable housing units. Does this section allow the counties the ability, because of that word shall, is it force them to develop a plan that is this overarching, or could it be as easy as codifying their code, saying we will accept, you know, these type of dwellings under a conditional use permit?
Representative Brock Smith, I interpret, and my intention in drafting this was that in that the county shall, one, I want them to do this, but two, the develop the process. In my mind, that's, here's the application you fill out if you're a church, not like you have to go and open up all of your plans. They've interpreted it that way. I don't interpret it that way. And I think the words notwithstanding other provisions of the law in the initial part of the section actually means that that's where I'm interpreting that they don't have to do it that way. And I am happy to go get an LC opinion to that effect, but that is neither my intent. I do want them to have a process. My interpretation of a process is, here's the form you fill out, not some big, huge, we have to open our books and change our you know, have this big, huge public process. It's just that there's a way for somebody who's a church or a nonprofit to come in and say, you know, hey, we're here to do this. Tell us what the building codes are. You know, because ultimately, you also can't cite one of these things if you don't have enough septic, if you don't have enough water. I mean, there's building codes. No one's saying don't, you know, you also get a free pass on the building codes. So the process in my mind is, how do they walk through the door and sell the county they want to do it? Not that the county has to have a big dog and pony show to get it done.
Follow up?
Brief one, yeah.
Thank you. Thank you for getting your intent on the record. I appreciate that. And then the second line, which is may, qualifying, may apply to the county. Does that allow the county some discretion or leeway on where the sightings of these would be? So if there is issues with locations of one of the churches, perhaps, would they have the ability to say no?
In that part, yes. I mean, Representative Brock Smith, I believe that if the land doesn't actually allow to hold a unit, like physically you can't site the septic, you can't site the well, there are other county codes, building codes, that would give a disapproval, that, right? You can't just say you're going to, if there's setback requirements or anything else, no one's asking for an exemption from building codes for this bill. We're just saying if the property works and you can make it work, then we shall let you build there. That's the intent.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. I am going to ask, thank you, Representative.
Go back to my committee.
Yep. I'm going to ask Nathan Hovekamp and Michael Silvaggio to come up and quickly talk about this one. You're on at least one other sheet on this general topic, so let me know if this is multiple topics you're covering or you want to come back.
Thank you, Representative Clem. Members of the committee, for the record, Michael Silvaggio. I'm here representing Central Oregon Land Watch. We are signed up on this bill also, 2937.
Yeah.
And we also were going to do a shout out on 2938. If it pleases you that we can make all those comments right now.
That'd be great.
Great.
So you know what? Why don't I just go ahead and open public hearings, because everyone else is going to be in the same category. Let me open public hearings on House Bill 2937, 2938, and we're already in one on 2456.
And Mr. Chair, although it's a little bit outside of the scope, we also are on 2222.
Yeah, I'll do okay. That separately.
In the interest of time, I'm going to defer everything to Mr. Hovekamp.
Okay.
So, Chair Clem and members of the committee, I'm Nathan Hovekamp. I'm the Wildlife Program Director for Central Oregon Land Watch. For more than 30 years, Land Watch has worked to protect what people love most about Central Oregon: our forest and high desert, our rivers and springs, our fish and wildlife, and well-designed communities. Land Watch plays a vital role in achieving a responsible, balanced approach to planning for and conserving Central Oregon's land and water resources while recognizing the needs of future generations. We work to protect and conserve the region's ecosystems and wildlife habitats, to foster thriving, sustainable communities, and to spread the cost and benefits of growth equitably across the community as a whole. So in regards to 2456, Land Watch supports affordable housing, particularly as a critical need in more expensive communities, but believes this bill diminishes protections for rural lands. We subscribe to the broader notion of affordable living, which includes proximity to employment, schools, health care, and other necessities and amenities better provided within urban growth boundaries. With regard to 2937, is that one also open, Chair Clem? Land Watch supports accessory dwelling units as a needed housing option, but believes this bill also diminishes protections for rural lands. We believe that the place for added density under our land use system is inside cities. That's what I have.
29. Oh. With regard to, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, with regard to 2938, we also oppose, again, citing recreational vehicles as residences for very similar reasons. Like Mr. Hofkamp indicated, affordable housing is an important issue. We do want to see some supply-side solutions there, but massing that solution on the edges of cities and in many cases outside of cities only serves to increase infrastructure and other costs to not only those residents but also to city residents.
Thank you, gentlemen. Okay, let me get some folks up to talk about a little work group that's been going. So colleagues on the committee, just so you know, these bills were all heard already in one committee. And at first when they asked, can we send it over here, I said, no, we have lots of other things to do. Why can't you just deal with it? But they wanted us to look at it from a land use lens because they were only looking at it through a housing lens. So in the meantime, testimony was already taken about the base bills and who liked them and who didn't. So then a work group was formed and some more work has been done. So some of this is about the base bill. So let's hear about the work group. So Commissioner Carlson, can you join us? And Mark, can you join us to tell us kind of what's happened in the meantime since it left the housing committee before it got here? Because we really don't want to just rehash the same exact thing that said in the housing committee, if at all possible.
Sure. Can I just give a little bit of an
Please?
Overview of what the bill is so the committee understands that? And thank you very much. I'm Janet Carlson, Marion County Commissioner. And I want to thank the chair for hearing the bill a second time and also for Julie Parrish for helping us get the note and for AOC for pulling together the work group. So this bill was intended to address housing supply. I spent the last year as county commissioner chairing a group called the Mid-Willamette Homeless Initiative. We have a 27-page strategic plan. A big part of our focus is going to be on housing supply. Also scrutinizing the codes that we have. And one of the barriers that we ran up against is that the statutes are really silent around this issue about dwellings on farmland and rural residential, but there's the one dwelling per parcel administrative rule through DLCD that really drives all of the things you've been hearing about this morning. Just as a side note, I want to say that I went around to virtually all the neighborhood associations. We had a telephone town hall with more than 1,000 people on it, and what we heard is people parked in RVs, living in RVs, not only in urban areas out in East Salem, Representative Clem in your district, and live there for a while on one street, go around the block and live somewhere else. People in parks, campgrounds along streams, in the neighborhoods, in the Rite Aid parking lot, our vacancy rate less than 1%, 0% in some of our rural communities. So we need more affordable housing, but we need more housing generally. And I think I'm not going to rehash what Representative Parrish talked about, but this is not a bill to say that we're going to make our planners start doing income eligibility to decide whether a person that lives in an accessory dwelling unit has a low income or not. This is saying that when everybody has more places to live, the market drives down the prices and it makes it more affordable for people. So we're working on accessory dwelling units in Salem, in Kaiser, in Marion County within the urban growth boundary. We'd like the same opportunity to do that in the rural residential area. So I'll skip my stories. I did submit the same testimony, tweaked a little bit that I had in the other committee, but we have been doing a work group. We had a two-hour meeting yesterday and want to thank all of the stakeholders that have been participating in that. There were a few sideboards that were put in 2937. I think what we have agreed to, and Mark can go through the details of it, but some of the big picture things are that we have pulled out the exclusive farm use and we're just focusing on rural residential. There's a story that goes along with it. You can read it in my testimony, but in order to move the bill forward, I think that that rural residential is where we need to be. We took Senator Monis Anderson's definition of accessory dwelling unit from Senate Bill 1024, which I believe they're hearing on the Senate side this week as well, and agreed to that. We're not really pushing 2938, the RV bill. We're going to see what we can do within the current law. I will say, just as parentheses to that, that while I have heard a lot of people say that RVs aren't the best place for people to live, I've also read an article on Trulia just the other day about tiny homes, and you have to get a storage bin, and where are you going to put your stuff? Well, you know, a lot of people that are homeless that are moving block to block don't have a lot of stuff to put in a storage bin, and if we're going to deal with the housing issue, I think we need to be looking at some creative steps. This is one tool in the toolbox. It is a small step. The average number of people that live in an accessory dwelling unit, research says, is 1.12. We're not putting millions of people, extra people out on farmland. It is simply a bedroom, a kitchen, and other states do this. My daughter lives in Boise. She drags me around open houses. They're on rural residential and in cities, and they work really well there. So I'm going to turn it over to Mark to kind of walk through where we are with the work group.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, after the first time we had a go-around with this, we decided to pull together a group of stakeholders, and yesterday we
Mark, did you tell us your name?
Oh, I'm sorry. I don't know if I did. Mark Nystrom, Association of Oregon Counties. I was on a roll there.
I know. So
some of the stakeholders and AOC didn't agree on everything. So I have a list that I can provide. This was late yesterday. I wanted to make sure that everyone had the chance to vet it. But I am going to talk about some of the ones that we agreed on, and I'll highlight some of the things that we still haven't come to agreement with. As Commissioner Carlson said, we agree that there's no ADUs on land zoned EFU. We really feel that it's important that these are permissive for counties, that we can't be preempting counties. All the bills that require us to do that, there's a code amendment and potentially plan updates that cost a lot of money. And so we want to make sure that the counties that are allowing these are the ones who want to do it. Mm-hmm. We went through a definition of accessory dwelling unit. We defined what rural residential was. None of these bills had a definition of what that is. Mm-hmm. And so with the help of DLCD, we came up with a definition that everyone agreed to. We have a lot minimum size that is still up for debate. I will say that it's somewhere in the 2 to 4 acre range. And we'll continue to talk about that issue. We all agree that it has to be situated on the same lot or parcel containing no more than one single-family dwelling. So it has to be on the same parcel as the existing house. It needs to either be within the existing house, attached to the existing house, or with 100 feet of the existing house. If it's interior, so if it's inside the house, let's say it's a basement ADU, it can't be, you know, it's the same size as the house. But if it's attached or detached, we're talking about putting a maximum size. The debate yesterday was between 800 and 1,000 feet, so we're still working on that one.
I suggested 900. But
pretty reasonable number.
We mentioned, and probably redundantly, that you need to obtain all permits related to standards relating to sanitation, safety, quality, and durability of units, making sure that they follow building codes. One of the issues, and Peggy explained it really well, was the whole groundwater restricted areas. We're trying to come up with a way that the counties and the folks living there have to demonstrate that they have enough water. Some of the folks would just not like to have them at all, so no ADUs in groundwater restricted areas. And then if it was detached from the single-family dwelling, we would recommend that it's or state that it's not situated in an area designated urban reserve. We want to make sure that Metro can do or the cities can do what they want to do in terms of UGB expansion at that point. And then the last two were a little bit controversial. One was if detached from a single-family dwelling not situated within 1 mile of a UGB of a city with a population greater than 10,000. The idea, again, you put a ring around the city because there needs to be room for UGB expansion. AOC was on a more flexible side of that. Folks on the other side of the spectrum were a little bit more tight on that. And that's one that we need to discuss. And then the issue of short-term rentals came up at the last minute. We didn't really get a chance to discuss that very much, but there was a recommendation of just saying no short-term rentals.
Okay.
And then number 14.
Oh, sorry.
That's an important one.
Yeah. Number 14, county may impose additional conditions.
Same as what we talked about
earlier. Right. So if Multnomah County or Marion County or Wheeler County want to put extra conditions on there, if they want to say it can only be 500 square feet, the county can say that.
Okay.
Quick question.
Vice Chair Springer and Rep. Escoval, then we got a bunch of people to
Thank
come
you,
up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Very quick question. You said no short-term rentals. Are you talking B&Bs? What is a short-term rental?
Yeah, the recommendation, Chair Clem, Vice Chair Springer, the recommendation was less than 60 consecutive days in a 12-month period.
Representative Escoval.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've been doing ADUs, or what we call granny flats, in Medford for 20 years, I think. And we have a very good ordinance there with a formula on how to construct those, and you might want to take a look at that just for a guideline to start, or a basis to start.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you both for coming. So let's figure out a logical way to do this. I know that you, Mark, sort of just presented in a more neutral fashion, but I assume AOC is in favor of the base bills. You're working with people who are opposed to this, so let's hear a little bit from the people who are opposed. If you don't know anything about this work group because you weren't there until today, I can understand why you'll want to talk about the base bills. But to the extent you just listened and heard where we're at now, it would be helpful if you could comment a little bit on what you progress that's been made. Does that help with your opposition? Having said that, Roger Kay, can you come up? Peter Kanagi and find another opposed. And Mary Kyle. And I've got 2937 and 2938 open. Roger, I've got you opposed to both. Mary Kyle, only one. And Peter opposed to both. So feel free to comment. Again, if you didn't know there was a work group and you just heard it for the first time right there, I know it's a little hard to have you react to it. So maybe mix in what you didn't like about the base bills and if you have any opinion on what you just heard.
Good morning, Chair Clem, members of the committee. My name is Roger Kay. I'm current president of Friends of Marin County. Our organization is 501c3 and formed in 1998. Our mission is to protect farm and forest land, parks, and open space. Our organization and its individual members are opposed to both of these measures, and we request a no vote. I understand I had some 4 points that I wish to mention. They're in my written testimony, and they basically I had no knowledge of the work group or the current discussions that had taken place. So rather than repeat all of this, I'd just like to say, even though the work group now proposes no ADUs on EFU, you must recognize that RR or AR land is also valuable resource land. Usually they're smaller sites. People live there because they want to engage in some sort of farming activity. These are still farm zones, although they're not EFU land, but they are normally smaller parcels, and they are important buffers. When you have ADUs on, let's say, a 5-acre parcel, sort of squeeze the water supply, squeeze the septic system. There's nothing about how many septic systems, how many wells. Actually, the number of wells are not regulated. You can have more than one well on a property. You can have 5 wells on a property, and there's no restriction on how much water you can take from those. So even in a groundwater limited area, there's going to be pressure on the water system, water table there. What about restrictions on partitioning? I just heard there was nothing mentioned about parcel size. Minimum parcel size on RR zoning is 2 acre. But you can have a 6-acre RR zone. You can still have one ADU, let's say 100 feet, and you can still partition that property. So that's my other concern. I don't know, that's about all of what I was going to say since I was covered in the work group. I wasn't really aware of those proceedings.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, my name is Peter Kanagi. I reside at 1650 Northeast North Nebergall Loop in Albany, Oregon. I'm a farmer. I'm originally opposed to all of these bills, both the 2937, 2938, and 2456. I was glad to hear the work group kind of sounds like they've nixed the RV one, which is good news. The palatability of it with the changes they've made to the RR zones is still really questionable in my mind. I mean, the rural residential zones fall into all sorts of categories. There's categories of rural residential zones that have places for those things that don't have overloaded traffic on the roads, and then there's other areas, rural residential zones, where adding additional residences and traffic on the roads are going to cause significant impacts. And it's not an efficient way to develop affordable housing. And the precept that these are ostensibly for affordable housing, it really is not. If we want to address affordable housing, these are not the ways to do it. And I would encourage you to, I mean, if you can't even get better out of those work groups, to nix both of these.
Now, Mary Carroll, are you in the work group? So you at least know, unlike these poor gentlemen who had no idea what the work group was doing. So can you tell us a little bit about your thoughts?
Good morning, Chair Clem, members of the committee. Mary Kyle McCurdy, representing 1,000 Friends of Oregon. We have been in two meetings of the work group and just saw this. Well, I haven't even read Mark's digestion of the points we talked about yesterday, because that just
which
came
out yesterday.
Too. Right. But we do, I want to say we appreciate that AOC approached us early on about these bills. They were described as being about affordable housing and accessory dwelling units. And we appreciate that they took the EFU portion out of these, but the resulting bills have not narrowed it to affordable housing units or even defined ADUs. And early on, we actually recommended what Representative Esquivel suggested, was looking at the way these have been defined inside urban growth boundaries that usually have ownership restrictions, size, that sort of thing. And the work group is working on those kinds of issues now to see those kinds of sideboards. They're a work in progress. Among other things, yesterday we heard for the first time the potential number of parcels that could potentially qualify for these just in rural residential areas in Marion County, and it was 2,600 parcels could potentially qualify, much fewer in some other counties. DLCD is just coming up with some of those numbers, so we're still getting in a lot of the information. I think we have out on the table in the 14 points you have the issues that need to be discussed, and narrowing in on some of them, but not we still have other ones. I mean, we're still working on some of them. So, and I think what you're hearing is the great variety of what is a rural residential area, varying from one home per 2 acres to one home per 20 acres, and the reasons those have that variety: groundwater, septic, wildfire risks, surrounding farm and forest uses, et cetera. So it's challenging, and there's been a lot of issues brought to the table. So we're still working on those, and we appreciate the opportunity to do that. Thank you.
Okay. Questions for this group? Okay, thank you very much. So what I'm going to do is, first of all, say that we're not doing anything with these bills today. We want the work group to keep meeting actively. Members of this committee may even decide they want to join the discussions from here on out. Some of us might. But having said that, we get a little more testimony. But we do have two other groups here on other totally different topics. So given we're not doing anything today and the work group's still going to meet and these things will still change even further, Mr. Chandler, why don't you come on up, and Jed Tompkins. These are on the four side. And give us your précis on the state of affairs, and should the work group keep meeting and talking?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builder Association. Yes, the work group should keep meeting. I was unable to attend the last meeting, as was pointed out to me by Commissioner Carlson. I will endeavor to make the next ones. Two things I want to mention. One is I think the work group is making progress. This is an important issue. It needs to be talked about. There are not only these bills, but another Senate bill that's having a hearing next week after next on the exact same topics. We're obviously going to be dealing with it this session, even if deciding to punt. But I don't think a punt's going to be necessary. I think we are getting close to what could be an agreement. One other point I want to mention, though, and this is with regard to the bill that Representative Leininger spoke to, 3012, it's a different take on this issue. It uses the same terminology, but when it would come up with a different type of an accessory dwelling unit than what 2937 or the other bill in front of you would. So I think at some point we're going to have to try to merge those two. I've done some drafting that's been shared with the work group. I'm not married to it, but to create, at least make it clear we're talking about substantially different things between a historic house replacement dwelling, or whatever we end up calling it, and a basement apartment or a room over the garage, because if they're both called ADUs, that's going to be very confusing, if nothing else. I do think it's important. I got into this issue, frankly, not because my clientele broadly is as much as it was one of my members who wanted to build a house who lives outside of the city of Salem, out in Marion County, wanted to build an accessory dwelling unit for a special needs daughter, and called me to ask me, did I know that you couldn't do ADUs in rural residential? And I said, no, I did not. So here we are. I think that's exactly what the kind of, at least from my perspective, what we were contemplating was elderly parents, children that couldn't afford to buy their own place, whatever it might be. And that, then, I think, is where the work group's trying to head, is to tailor this so that it doesn't become just an additional batch of houses out in the countryside, but actually be accessory to, as the name implies, the main structure. With regard to Representative Parrish's bill, since you did gavel and everything, I think we really do, with the housing crisis we have, our agenda ought to be all the above. And I really applaud her for bringing that bill forward. I think it addresses as creative a take on the issue. You guys already voted on one bill on this topic. Dang it. But I think that there are other issues in front of us, and that may be one of them, where we simply try to advance the cause of housing, generally speaking, and put some focus on doing it in as many creative ways as we can until we get on top of the issues that's plaguing so many areas in Oregon. With that, I'll take questions. Thank you very much for your consideration.
Okay, let's hear from Judd first.
Thank you, Chair Clinton, members of the committee. Judd Tompkins, Assistant Multnomah County Attorney, on behalf of Multnomah County. We did participate in the work group, and we are looking forward to continuing those conversations. I do just want, on the record before this committee, to explain briefly here why this is a complicated issue, why there's a list of 15 sideboards or more and counting that we're adding to this bill. We do, just to get on the record here, oppose the bill as introduced, and we would oppose really any version that's short of resolving all the issues that the work group's been discussing. Resolving those issues, I think we'd back off, be neutral. But the reason this is difficult, the reason this is complicated, is that this is a real shift in how we've planned for these rural areas for decades, since the 70s, even more focused since the 80s with a Supreme Court decision on what is rural, what happens out there, and what happens inside the UGB. If we look to other states, just remember, other states don't have this planning process with the UGB. Some have things that are similar, but we're a little bit unique in this. And what I'm talking about is we are really directing residential use inside the UGB. And there's quite a bit of land inside the UGBs in Oregon. And there's at least two reasons for this. One is it encourages this residential use and development in areas that are efficiently served by public services, utilities, transportation, schools, et cetera, et cetera. The other is, we are protecting our resource lands and our resource industries, the farming and forest industries. Another reason to be careful about adding,
Jed, before we have a long soliloquy between you and I on land use, which I love, I've got a bunch of other people here on other bills that came more than 100 miles, so can we, 10 more seconds, and we'll
can I
talk
do 45 seconds?
No, we'll talk next time, because we're going to hear these bills all over again after the work group meets.
Okay. You get it.
Yeah. We'll be back.
Thank you.
We'll come back.
Seconds.
That was good.
That was 3 seconds, right?
That was good.
Right.
Okay.
Thank you. I appreciate the moment.
Okay. Thank you. And we'll be back onto these bills. Work group, keep meeting. Committee members who want to be in the work group, keep meeting. Marianne, can you come up really quick? And you nice ladies who are really mad at me if I don't let you talk, come on up. Please be brief, because we have a bunch of people who were not stuck in traffic, and they've been sitting here 2 hours waiting to talk, and we have 11 minutes total left.
Thank you very much. Chair Clem, members of the committee, Marianne Nash, Oregon Farm Bureau. We had big concerns about this bill on EFU. We appreciate it's being limited down.
You're in the work group?
We're in the work group.
Okay, keep going to the work group, yes.
We'll keep going to the work group.
Okay, please.
I'm Ava Chapman from Portland, Oregon, and I am a rural property owner in Multnomah County, and I would like to say I love that it's moved on and you guys are considering this and we have a work group going. But being in Multnomah County, what I heard is that all these counties that we might not be able to do that based off of some of the codes that they have. And what happened when the majority of the room was filled in Multnomah County, not only with the land use planning and with the commissioners that were wanting ADUs to use even for forestry people, for people with EFUs or many different circumstances wanted to have ADUs, even whether it be a cot in a tent, we're told that we could not do that. Multnomah County at that time was asked by, there was a representative who came from Salem down at that meeting and said, could you please pause from doing this amendment in the code, 32 through 38, until after this legislative session. And they totally ignored that request, ignored people in the room, and pushed these new amendments through that make it so difficult that even with my agricultural building, I can't even put a restroom in my barn agricultural building because they're afraid I'm going to make it into an ADU. So in this working session, I would love to participate in it as well to communicate some of this. We're going to be totally shut out where we actually are close to the urban growth boundary where services are there. There could be so many benefits. And in regard to what I would like to do with my property, is there's a farmhouse bill 2085, which would allow a tax credit for renting lands to beginner farmers. I would love to have that on my property. I would love to age on my property. I would love to have an ADU. I don't have money like my mom does to spend $8,000 or $9,000 a month to stay at Mary's Woods, right? For care. I would like to age on my property. I would like to help a farmer. I would like to give employment to someone. I would like to create a larger, greater neighborhood for this and not become a burden as I age, be able to stay on my property. Thank you very much.
Any please?
Right, way down. Good morning. My name is Karen Friedman. I'd like to express my support for House Bill 2937 in favor of ADUs. I live on a rural residential property, and we have a small barn that is underutilized and would be ideal to use as an extra dwelling for when my children come to visit. Thank you.
That was great. Okay, thank you. Okay, that's everybody. We'll be back to these topics again. Please go back to the work group. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2937, 2456, and 2938. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2222 again. Nick Lelak, can you join us? I know you drove all the way from Bend for this. I'm sorry that we're not more on time. Tell us more about 2222.
Thank you, Chair Clem, and members of the committee. Nick Lelak, Deschutes County Community Development Director, and I'm joined by County Commissioner Anthony DeBone from Deschutes County behind me as well. And we are in support of House Bill 2222-3, and we're also representing the support of the Association of Oregon Counties. Given the limited time, and you may choose to hear from others. I'll keep my comments very brief. First, I did submit a fairly detailed letter with maps and photographs into the record that I hope you'll take a look at. That really captures the issues very, very well overall. I'll just hit a couple of points that I've heard raised this morning so far. First, Eastern Oregon, yes, we do have high-value farmland,
yeah,
and we do have the Rocky Mountains. I can confirm we have them both in our county, and this bill is aimed at the spectrum on from the dry to the rocky landscape, not the high-value farmland or even quality farmland or even farmland that is irrigated and has ever even been productively used. It's on the other spectrum of that. So I want to just emphasize that first. Second, we do have lands that are not correctly designated as agriculture or forestry in Deschutes County. This is recently demonstrated by the Oregon Department of State Lands. They rezoned, and with a comprehensive plan amendment, 340 acres from agriculture EFU to a non-resource zone, a rural residential exception area on the east side of Bend. It had poor soils, it's never had irrigation, it's never been productively used as farmland. They're now in the process of hiring a consultant to do another 300 acres. So that's one recent example. It's very, very expensive. It's tens of thousands of dollars in consulting fees and county fees to go through that process, and a lot of residents can't afford that. So this bill would provide the county the opportunity to undertake such a study for more property owners. The other issue that Chair Clem, that you mentioned earlier, I think is very valuable, is could we correct mapping errors on, for example, the Big Look bill? And we raised that question during the Southern Oregon Pilot Project. We had actually asked to participate in that and then stood down when we weren't selected, which was fine, but we didn't let this issue stand idle. We approached the Department of Land Conservation and Development, whom we have an outstanding relationship with, about could we correct some of those mapping errors that we have. And they explained to us, and we understand now, that some of those mapping errors, if they were incorrectly designated at the time that we created our comprehensive plan, so in the late 1970s and early 1980s, if they were not incorrectly designated then, even if they are partially developed now, circumstances around those properties now have changed. They are not eligible for reconsideration or for reevaluation under the Big Look bill. There would need to be another avenue to consider those. And some of the maps I provided in the testimony with those subdivisions, for example, they were vacant, they were undeveloped in the early 1980s. And because of that, the department, DLCD's perspective was, because they're vacant, they can still be used for farm or forest. Well, since that time, and I heard the term before used, the dog and pony show for a conditional use permit, those properties are developed individually, but it's a big dog and pony show to get them developed. It's through a non-farm dwelling or a template forest dwelling process. And these are platted subdivisions, and we would like to correct those mapping errors. It's just like a rural residential subdivision, it's just that they have the misdesignation of farm or forest. We attempted to learn from the Southern Oregon Regional Pilot Project with some of the elements in this bill, such as allowing one county that I heard earlier. Different counties have different interests, and we would like the opportunity to pursue it individually. So given the time, I'll conclude my comments, and thank you very much for your time.
Okay. Thanks, Nick. Nathan Hovekamp, your other person who came from more than 100 miles, do you want to come briefly talk about this? And then, Jim, could you join us? I do want to just talk for a second. Can you? Is that okay? Because I think we want to spend some time on this remapping issue that Representative Esko all raised and figure out. I had kind of forgotten about it since Big Look, but I think we do want to talk more about that. Okay, Nathan.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, good morning. Thanks again. Nathan Hofkamp, Central Oregon Land Watch. Lived in Bend for 20 years, but I always like to come over here and get some of your all's liquid sunshine. Thanks for the opportunity. In regards to 2222, Central Oregon Land Watch strongly supports Oregon's landmark statewide land use planning goals and system, and opposes attempts to regionalize or weaken these protections. While every community in the state has its own unique or distinguishing characteristics and challenges, there are manifest benefits common to all communities in Oregon, from citizen involvement in land use decisions, orderly land use planning and development, preservation of farm and forest lands, and protection of natural resources. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2022. I know there's people still here, but
that's what I hate.
We are. We'll either come back and talk about it or not. I'm not sure yet. But the rest of the people, I think, are all opposed. I think you're likely to prevail. So rather than dance on your opponent's grave, I'm just going to tend for now. So the other people who are here on the dog tethering bill can talk a little bit. And we'll discuss it, because I think there's something here, but probably not quite ready for prime time yet. So let me close the public hearing on House Bill 2222. Open the public hearing on House Bill 3044. Ask Darren Campbell, Roger Goodell, and John Hopkinson to come up. Their committee members are going to all be leaving, probably, but me. Don't be offended.
No work sessions today?
No, we'll carry them over. They have other meetings. We're late, but I'm going to sit here for a while and talk about animal tethering.
Representative Clem, members of the committee, Darren Campbell. Usually I'm in the building representing taxi cab industry, but I got involved in this bill to help out Oregon Humane Society because they supplied me with great dogs over the years, and my father used to serve on the board of directors there. Good bill should pass. I'll submit my testimony to OLIS. The only thing I will add is that we do have -1 amendments that adds the farm exemption, which was added to the bill last time that it passed this committee in 2015. And then there's also some individuals who are going to submit -2s in regards to scent hunting. And we'll see if we're on board with those. If the language works out right, I don't foresee a problem with that. But
okay.
I'll leave it at that.
Thanks, Roger.
Good morning, Chairman. My name is Roger Cadell, and I'm with Columbia County Animal Control, and I work a lot with the Oregon and Maine, and they asked me to come speak today. I'm going to address the public safety issue on this rather than the animal safety, which is usually what the Oregon and Maine goes for. I've been an animal control officer 12 years, as a police officer for 15 years before that. The concern I have with dogs in the back of vehicles is specifically things that I've seen. I've seen dogs jump out of trucks and attack people on the street while they were walking their dogs. I've seen dogs jump out of the back of vehicles, into traffic, cause vehicle accidents, dogs get killed, people get injured. I get numerous complaints about dogs jumping out of vehicles, attacking people, attacking dogs, running off, getting lost. So there's a public safety issue for the general public, not just the animal being transported in the back of the vehicle being injured. So that was my consideration here is, from the things that I enforce the laws I deal with. The other factor is enforcement. Having been a police officer, laws need to be specific. And I think the last law that is currently in effect is a little vague, and so it makes it hard for officers to want to enforce the law because there's, you know, how tall does the bed have to be? How secure does the animal have to be? I've actually seen animals tethered in the back of trucks, hung on the side of the truck because the tether was too long. We adopted one dog from a shelter. It did not make it home because it hung itself. So the type of security needs to be the cross tethering, the container in the back of the truck, because it provides safety for the animal as well as for the public. Enforcement, having specific rules that say you can do this, this, and this are important for people to have for the enforcement side, because otherwise officers won't enforce it. There was some discussion on the working dog exemption, whether it's hunting dogs or farm dogs. I myself have no problem because I deal with that working dog exemption on a lot of other laws that I deal with on animals, like the Farm Dog of the Farm Bill Act and things like that to protect, allow for certain farm dogs to do certain things. So I would support that exemption as well for those dogs that are engaged in work activities. But the general person going down the street with a dog in the back of the truck, it's just asking for trouble to happen.
And is there a current law on this already that you need to do some amount of tethering? Or?
There is a current, because I think this is amending the statute, and my understanding it says protected by framework carrier, other device sufficient to keep it from falling from the vehicle. That leaves for interpretation. I suppose if a dog jumps out of the, because it says falling out of the vehicle, so if the dog jumps out of the vehicle, it didn't fall out, it jumped out. And that's the thing that I've seen. I saw one viciously attack two people on the street and tear up their dog when it jumped out of a vehicle, and the drive car just kept on going down the road. They didn't know their dog was even out of the vehicle.
Okay, John.
Thank you, Chair Clem and members of the committee. My name is John Hopkins, and I work for the Oregon Humane Society. I'll be very brief. I just want to explain the handout that you got, and also just first say that the Oregon Humane Society is not affiliated with any local or national organization, and we receive no tax funding. So I've been with the Investigations Department for a couple of years now, and we've been inundated with complaints and reports from concerned Oregonians. So I put together a sample for you. It's about 20 pages, and it's broken up into four sections that seem to be concerning to Oregonians. The first is dogs traveling at very high speeds on freeways in pickups, as well as dogs left unattended parked in urban areas, which is what Roger was referring to. Mm-hmm. The second one is dogs leaning out or in the stage of falling out. The third is no barriers or insufficient barriers to protect the dog in the pickup. And the fourth is extreme or adverse weather conditions. And then after that, there's a couple of fact sheet PDFs that are a page or two from, one's from Ford, one's from AAA, and one's from the AVMA, which is the American Veterinary Medical Association. So these are organizations or companies that are experts in car safety and animal safety. And the bottom line is that it's obviously not safe for the dog, but it's also not safe for the passengers of the car, as well as other passengers, and it's very distracting to other drivers as well. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. And then I'm just going to get the other side up here real quick so we have at least a little flavor of both. Marianne, and is former Representative Soa still here? Did we lose him?
He might be outside.
And
there he is.
Stan, do you want to join them? I know you're not on the same side of the signed up the same way, but I know you're not going to kick anybody under the table, so we can all get along. Okay, Marianne.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, for the record, Marianne Nash here today on behalf of the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. I think for us, this bill, as I was talking to my members about it, really became kind of an urban-rural divide issue for us, because overwhelmingly I heard, you know, they don't really understand how it is out in Burns when my dog is, you know, goes out on the ranch with me, goes out to feed cows. They're not in F-plated vehicles a lot of the time when they're doing that, and they need to be able to come in and out of the vehicle. And it's also just, you know, one of our livestock committee chair lives in Bend, and he said, you know, I've lived in this community my whole life. You know, I haven't heard incidents of this happening. This is not a problem here. These dogs are trained from an early age to ride in the back of the pickup. They wouldn't be comfortable in a carrier. And they're not, you know, driving down I-5 or parked in the middle of Portland. They're going into around Burns, in and around their ranch, and not encountering, I think, the kinds of dangerous situations that you're hearing about that could take place in urban areas. And so I think for us, this is just kind of a fundamental, you know, these are largely working dogs that you need to be able to take around your ranch and use on your ranch. But yes, they may occasionally pop into town and, you know, grab something from the store and head back out. And they're traveling at, you know, reasonable rates of speed. The dogs are used to traveling in the pickups. They're not hopping out. And so for us, this is not an issue we've seen in these rural areas. Certainly, I think I think most of our ranchers wouldn't take their dogs on I-5 down into downtown Portland. They're leaving them at home for those kinds of trips. And so, I think when you're in rural communities, it's going to be a very hard distinction to craft the bill in a way that is going to allow folks to, you know, to continue to use their working animals as they've been using their working animals, and not pose a huge burden on them and a huge burden on, quite frankly, retraining the animals. And so for us, I think we had looked at compromises last year, looked at ways to craft this, and it's really difficult because of the ways our folks are using dogs and the fact that they're looking in these rural areas and they're saying, we haven't seen issues, we would hear about it. These are working stock dogs. They pay a lot of good money for these dogs and train them well. They treat them well, and they would hear about it if there were a lot of incidents of dogs falling out of pickups or having big issues, and we're not hearing those reports from the rural parts of the state.
Okay. Former representative, welcome back.
For the record, my name is Larry Soa. As you said, I'm a former representative, but to tell you who I am, I was just completed 30 years as a elected representative from Clackamas County. And fact is, I just filed for re-election to the local water board, but that's not important here. I've conducted hundreds of town halls and all kinds of meetings and things, so I think I understand what Clackamas County people feel. We want to keep the land use system wants to keep Clackamas County livable, rural, keep the urban sprawl out of there. At the same time, we want to keep it so that people can do what they want to do. And our county has changed quite a bit in the last 30 years since I first was elected, but now we have a lot of people moving into the county that bring with them their pets, and they're in order to justify living on 5 acres or whatever it is and in the county, they bring with them their livestock. So I think my opposition to the bill is I think the people that put it forward probably have good intentions about protecting the animals, the dogs and the livestock that they might come into contact with. But in order to make the bill workable, we have to do something with the word highway. There are thousands of miles of roads in Clackamas County that are on timberland, national forest land, state forest, everything, and most of it's open to the people. And the definition in the state statutes that tell you what highways are includes all those roads, and many of them are back roads that are people don't drive over 20, 30 miles an hour, and so the dogs are not in jeopardy as much as they are on a paved or a city street. So we need to figure out how to change that. Also, the other day I was at a farm store where they sold farm feed and hay and stuff like that. And while I was there looking at the bulletin board, there were 6 trucks pulled in. All of them had dogs in them. The guys just got out, went in to buy their things, whatever they came for. And not one of those dogs that were in the back of those pickups jumped out. And they didn't get in fight with the dog next door. They're trained dogs. And so I think we need some kind of exemption for those farm dogs. They're valuable, well taken care of, outside dogs. But when the guy leaves that place, he takes his dog with him. And they're not tied up in the back of those trucks. The bill proposes to solve the problem of dogs loose in the back of the truck by making the sidewalls, I think it's 46 inches. I guarantee you that every one of those dogs in there, if the owner walked out and called them, they would jump over a 46-inch wall. So we have to figure out how to solve that problem. Stan has some proposed amendments, Stan Steele, to exempt those kind of working dogs and some hunting dogs and things like that to make it so it's not so onerous on the public of Clackamas County. And we support those amendments. We'll participate in making sure that they solve our problems as well as the people in the city they're concerned about. Safety of dogs.
Okay, Stan, why don't you tell us a little bit, but it's clear this is going to need more work. We're not doing anything, if at all, this session, not for probably at least a week or more until closer to the end. So we're going to talk about this again on another day, but if you want to share just a thought or two now and then come back if we work something out here.
Chair Clem, committee members, the amendments would be you know, this is a good bill. The intentions are good. There's no question. We want to protect the public as well as our dogs. But how we get there is probably where we're at. And the current amendment just says farm vehicle registered. Well, you realize that most of the ranchers and sheepers that I'm good friends with don't have their vehicle registered as a farm vehicle. It's a motor vehicle, Ford pickup. It's just got a regular passenger license on it. Farm vehicle registrations often go
just the big
situations.
Truck gets that, not
so
all the little ones sometimes.
So we need to work with that. And then for the working dogs, let's just give a definition. We did it last time when we actually worked on a tethering. And we can go there with that type of definition, and that will work for us. So long story short, still need some work. We understand the need. Let's get there and make a good bill.
Okay. Thank you very much. I know we have one more guest here, but I think he's one of your crew, Stan, David, something or other. Did you want to echo Representative Witt?
I was just wondering if there was time to ask this panel a question before we dismiss
it. Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you, Susan. I thought that you may have even defined the three of you kind of where the middle ground is possibly here. One way would potentially be a definition not unlike what was crafted for an earlier bill. Another alternative possibly could be animals traveling, so it's not parked, but traveling on roads or highways with a speed limit in excess of pick whatever figure that folks might land on thinking that was reasonable. I mean, I think there are ways to protect both sides of the interest here, both protecting the animals and the public, but also allowing and providing for people who have working dogs, et cetera, to be able to accommodate those interests on a daily working basis. So,
I think there are. Yeah, I would agree. I'd be a little bit worried about speed limitations being part of it. That's so open to interpretation by enforcement. Sometimes but I do think Representative Witt and Chair Clem and that there are some things that we could work with our others that are interested in this and get there.
Okay, I would like to hear from David Walker. So thank you all for coming. And David, do you join us?
I can pass and just I'm working with Stan on it. So
okay.
I basically have the same feeling.
Okay, we'll put you in the room with the other side, not the other side, but the people who all want to protect animals and work on a little more language. Okay. Thank you, everybody, for coming. I am going to carry over the work session on House Bill 3147, only because I forgot to do it earlier, and I've now lost a quorum, but I should have done it earlier because it was an easy one. So let me carry that over. I already carried over 2099. I think we closed all the other public hearings, and we'll adjourn the committee. Thank you. That was the committee. Thank you.